Chapter 13. A group of five Latinos, one of whom was wounded, would have stood out in a town as small as Forks and Port Angeles, so Espinoza and his men were forced to return to Seattle. Their injured comrade, shot through the side, suffered in silence for the hours it took to drive to the city. It wasn't until they were in the seedy hotel on the outskirts of the city that they were able to treat the wound properly. It had been a clean in-and-out and hadn't perforated the intestine, so unless he developed an infection, he should be fine. They loaded him up with over-the-counter medications and half a bottle of brandy. Once his men were settled, Espinoza returned to the room he shared with Raúl Jiménez. He asked his friend to excuse himself and powered up a satellite phone. He wasn't sure how his father would react to the call. He was nervous, nonetheless. "Report," his father said by way of greeting, no doubt recognizing the number. Espinoza hesitated, well aware that the computers of the American NSA monitored nearly every wireless transmission in the world, trolling through the mountains of data for keywords that would make the call of interest to the intelligence community. "We ran into competition. The same man I saw a couple of days ago." I wasn't sure they would be interested, nor did I expect them to move so fast, the general said. "What happened?" "The target was collateralized, and one of my men was grazed." "I don't care about your men. Do you learn anything, or have you failed me again?" "I retrieved a document," Espinoza replied. "I think the American tried to destroy it by throwing it into a fire before making his escape. However, we entered the target's house before it was damaged. You said it was possible we'd find evidence that the target knew something about China, so when I saw it on the kitchen floor, I grabbed it. It appears to be a rubbing of some kind, like when families make tracings of headstones. It shows the map of a bay, but no location is given. There are glyphs on it that almost look like some Asian language." "Chinese?" The general's tone was eager. "It looks like it." "Excellent. If this leads where I think it might, we are going to change the world, Jorge. Were you able to speak to the target?"
The elder Espinoza hadn't explained what it was he was after, but the words of praise made his son swell with pride. "He was already gone when we got inside. We burned his house to the ground afterward. I doubt they will bother checking the body for any sign of foul play, so we're clear." "Where are you now?"
"Seattle."
"Do you want us to return home?"
"No, not yet. Tomorrow I want you to overnight the rubbing to me."
The general paused. Jorge knew his father was considering angles and odds. He finally asked, "What do you think the competition will do now?"
"It depends if they extracted any useful information from the target. I checked the hood of their truck when we reached the house. It was still warm, so they hadn't been there long."
"They were interested enough to reach out to the target," General Espinoza said, more for his own benefit than his son's. "Will they continue on, or have they had enough?"
"If I may hazard a guess, the men were obviously soldiers. I think it's most likely they came here to tell the target about his brothers as a military courtesy. A band of brothers type thing."
"Do you believe they will drop it?"
"I think they will tell their superiors what happened tonight, and it will be they who decide to drop it."
"Yes, that's most likely how the military would act. There is no obvious threat to national security, so the soldiers will be told to stand down. Even if they want to pursue it, they will have their orders to let it go."
"This is good, Jorge. Very good."
"Thank you, sir.
May I ask what this is all about?"
General Espinoza chuckled. "Even if we were alone together here at the house, I could not tell you. I am sorry. I can say that in a few days an alliance is going to be announced that will forever change the world's balance of power, and if I am correct about your find,
you will have contributed to its success. I sent you to hunt a wild goose, and it may yet turn out to lay a golden egg."
His father wasn't one to use such a frivolous turn of phrase, so Jorge took it as a sign of his happiness. Like any good son, he was especially proud when he could bring his father joy. "See to your injured man," the general continued, "and be ready to move at a moment's notice. I am not sure if you will come back home or if you will have another mission. It all depends what we learn from the rubbing." He paused to give weight to his following words. "I am proud of you, son."
"Thank you, father. It's all I ever want you to be."
Espinoza hung up. He had more on his mind than simply waiting for orders. He wasn't sure what the Americans had learned from the old man, but it wasn't unreasonable to guess they might show up at his private island. Cabrillo had always held the belief that if you threw enough money at a problem, it would go away, and he figured getting to the bottom of the treasure pit should be no different. He and Max spent 2 hours in the woods watching the cheery glow of the fire as James Ronish's little ranch house burned to the ground. They waited that long to make sure the better-armed Argentines had left the area. Nothing remained of the house but a toppled chimney and smoldering ash piles that spat and hissed in the rain. As a parting gift, all 4 tires on their rented SUV had been shot out, forcing them to drive back to the motel on flats. Before they could think about hot showers and beds, they had to cut up the tires to retrieve the bullets, so when they brought the truck to a garage, the mechanic wouldn't report the incident to the police. They also smashed a headlight and keyed dozens of random lines into the glossy paint. Coming on the heels of such a fatal fire, it wouldn't do to arouse any kind of suspicion in the sleepy little town. The truck looked like the victim of juvenile vandals. It was this kind of attention to detail, no matter how minute, that made the corporation such a success. The next morning, while Max went to find a garage to get the truck repaired, muttering about those damn kids these days, Juan set up a video conference with his brain trust. When he told Mark and Eric that he had no choice but to dive the treasure pit, they looked like they were ready to jump ship to join him. "My question to you is, how do I do it? How do I duplicate what only the Ronish brothers managed to accomplish on the eve of World War II? "Have you gone over the information you recovered from the Flying Dutchman?" Eric asked. Juan had caught them eating breakfast. Over Stone's shoulder, Mark Murphy was munching on a banana. "They could have left a clue there." "I took a quick peek. Despite the protection, the paper is in pretty bad shape. I don't know if I'll be able to get anything off of it." "Assume I can't, and tell me what you two think. The pit has thwarted a number of attempts. You mentioned one that used some pretty high-tech solutions, and yet they failed. What do you think the brothers figured out?" Mark swallowed a mouthful of food and said, "We know their first attempt ended in disaster, so obviously one of them learned something during the war that gave him the answer."
"Which one?"
"I doubt the pilot. He was an observer on a blimp. I can't imagine that kind of job giving him much inspiration." "So it's either the Marine or the Army Ranger," Juan said. Mark leaned in toward the webcam. "Look, this is an engineering problem. Hydrodynamics, stuff like that. The Marines faced some pretty tricky booby traps as they fought their way to Japan. My bet is, he saw something the Japanese had done and thought Pierre Devereux had come up with it first." Eric looked at him crossways and said what Cabrillo was about to. "You still think this is about an old pirate? There's no way the Argentines would be this interested if the treasure pit turns out to be just that." Murph looked a little defensive. "What is it about, then?"
"Obviously, I can't answer that question."
Eric turned back to Juan.
"Do you have any ideas, Chairman?"
"Nothing. Ronish died before he could talk, and Max and I weren't in any position to search his place. Come on, think. What did they figure out? How do we crack the treasure pit?" Mark tapped his chin.
"A device.
A device. A booby trap. Something involving water. Hydrostatic pressure. You have an idea?
Murph didn't answer because he didn't have one.
Sorry, man. I've been so wrapped up in the history, I never really thought about the technology.
Juan blew out a breath.
Okay. Don't sweat it. Max and I will think of something.
May I ask what? Eric said.
God, no. I'm winging it here. For the next hour, they created a list of equipment the pair might need and went about filling it. What couldn't be purchased in Port Angeles would be delivered from Seattle. By the time they were done, a delivery van was headed to Forks from Washington's Queen City, and a small ferry was underway from Port Angeles and would pick up Max and Cabrillo at the fishing pier in the town of La Push. That coastal village was just a few miles north of Pine Island. The only problem was that they would lose another day because the sophisticated underwater communications equipment was coming in as air freight from San Diego. When it was all said and done, there was an additional $40,000 worth of charges on the chairman's Amex, but as he'd always believed, problem solved. Hopefully. He asked about the crew's morale, especially Mike Trono's.
Eric said, he spent an hour or so after the service talking with Doc Huxley. She was the Oregon's de facto shrink. He says he's fit for active duty. Linda cleared it with Hux, so he's back working with the rest of the fire breathers.
Probably for the best. Staying busy is a hell of a lot better than sitting still.
Cabrillo knew that he was taking his own advice.
We'll call you when we're set up on Pine Island. I assume you want video feed when we're there.
Hell yes, they said in unison. Juan killed the connection and refolded his computer. Their deliveries from Seattle and Port Angeles arrived late in the afternoon, so it wasn't until the following morning that Max and Cabrillo headed for La Push. The ferry was a couple hours late because of wind, but they made the transfer quickly, driving the retired SUV onto the boat from the dock. With a capacity of only four vehicles and a relatively flat bottom, the ferry was at the mercy of the sea. The ride down to Pine Island was a battle between the boat's diesel engine and the waves that crashed over the bow. Fortunately, the captain knew these waters and handled his charge very well. He was also being paid to forget this trip ever took place. The approach to Pine Island went smoothly because its only beach was a lee of the wind. They could only get about 40 feet from shore before they had to lower the front ramp. Juan estimated they were in at least 5 feet of water. He looked across to see that Max was strapped in before backing the Explorer to the very back of the ferry. Ready? Hanley tightened his grip on the armrest. Hit it. Juan mashed the gas pedal and the Ford's tires chirped against the deck. The heavy truck shot across the ferry and raced down the ramp. It hit the ocean in a creaming wall of water that surged over the hood and then over the roof, but there was enough momentum to shoulder most of it aside. The weight of the engine dragged the nose down, allowing the front tires to find purchase on the shale seabed. It wasn't elegant, and the motor was sputtering by the time the grill emerged from the water, but they made it. Juan bowled the SUV up onto the beach, shouting and cajoling the truck until all four tires were on solid ground.
You enjoyed that, didn't you?
Max was a little paler. Juan shot him a grin.
And have you considered how we're going to load this thing back on the ferry when we're done?
As you may recall, I got the full insurance package when I filled out the rental forms. Today is not budget rent-a-car's lucky day.
Should have told me that. Otherwise I would have bought retreads rather than new tires.
Juan blew out of breath like a long-suffering spouse.
We never talk anymore.
He parked just above the tide line. They had discussed the possibility that the Argentines would anticipate them coming to Pine Island and lay a trap. While Max got some equipment together, Juan scanned the beach for any sign that someone had come ashore recently. The shale tiles looked undisturbed. There were no depressions like the ones his feet made with every step. He knew from talking with Max and Eric that this was the only place where someone could gain access to the island,
so we felt pretty confident that no one had set foot here in a long time. They had brought battery-powered remote motion detectors that could send a wireless alert to Cabrillo's laptop. He had several of them on the beach, facing inland so the motion of waves hitting shore wouldn't trigger them. It was the best they could do with only the two people. The track leading to the pit was heavily overgrown, and it taxed the SUV's off-road capabilities to the limit. Small trees and shrubs vanished under the front bumper and scraped against the undercarriage. They saw evidence that people did continue to visit Pine Island, despite the property being posted off-limits. There were several fire pits where local teens camped. Detritus of parties littered the clearings, and long-faded initials were carved in some trees. "This must be the local version of Lover's Lane," Max remarked.
"Just so long as you don't get any ideas," Juan grinned.
"Your virtue is safe." The area immediately around the pit was little changed from when the Ronish brothers came here that first time in December of 1941, with one notable exception. A steel plate had been bolted over the opening into the rock. It was badly rusted, having been exposed to the elements for the past 30-plus years since it was installed at James Ronish's insistence, but still remained solid. Mark had warned them about this, and they had come prepared. The real difference lay just offshore, where concrete pylons had been driven across the mouth of a narrow inlet. When Duane Sullivan tried to drain the pit, they had blocked off the bay because it was the most likely source of the water that defeated his pumps every day. The inlet had since refilled, but the water looked stagnant, meaning the cofferdam kept it from mixing with the ocean. Juan started unloading equipment while Max lugged an oxyacetylene cutting torch to the large piece of steel. The plate itself was too thick to slice efficiently, so he attacked the bolt heads. With the torch burning at over 6,000 degrees, the bolts didn't stand a chance. He cut off all eight and silenced the hissing torch. The smell of scalded metal was quickly whipped away by the steady offshore breeze. The tow hook on the winch attached to the SUV's bumper slipped over the metal plate, and when Hanley took up the slack, the chunk of steel slid smoothly across the rocks and revealed the yawning opening into the earth that had intrigued people for generations.
"I can't believe I'm about to dive the treasure pit," Juan said. "When I was a kid, I followed Duane Sullivan's expedition in the papers, dreaming of being on his team."
"Must be a West Coast thing," Max replied. "I'd never heard of this place until Murph and Stoney's briefing."
"Besides, you have no whimsy," Cabrillo teased, copying Eric Stone's earlier observation.
The dive gear they had ordered from Seattle was top of the line. Juan would have a full-face dive helmet with a fiber-optic voice and data link to Max on the surface. A tiny camera mounted on the side of the helmet would allow Hanley to see everything the chairman did. Diving alone, especially underground, was never a good idea, but if something happened to Juan when he was in the pit, Max would know about it and be able to haul him back up. "You ready?" Max asked when Juan finished cinching a utility belt over his dry suit. Cabrillo gave him the okay sign. Divers never give the thumbs up unless they are about to surface. "Keep watch on the computer for those motion sensors. If one goes off, get me up to the surface as fast as you can." Max had his pistol secreted in the small of his back and Juan's on the seat next to him. "I doubt they're coming, but we're ready." Juan clipped the winch hook to his belt and slowly eased himself off the steel plate and into the treasure pit. There was no sense of how high he was over the bottom because the shaft was inky black. He had yet to put on his helmet. The air was layered with the thick stench of rotting kelp and the iodine tang of the sea. His halogen light pushed only a few feet into the darkness before being swallowed up. "Ready?" Max asked. "Lower away," Juan replied, and slipped his helmet over his head and locked it to the collar ring. The air from the tanks on his back was fresh and cool. The winch paid out cable at a steady 60 feet a minute. Juan observed the rock walls below the thick wooden supports placed here some time in the past by person or persons unknown. Where the Ronish brothers had used oakum to block water seeps, The 1978 expedition had used fast-drying hydraulic grout to fill any crack or crevice, and from the look of them, it was still doing the job. The walls were bone dry.
"How are you doing?"
Mac's question came down the fiber optics. Darkness sucked at Cabrillo's dangling feet.
"Oh, just hanging on. How far down am I?"
"About 100 feet. See anything yet?"
"Murk. Lots and lots of murk."
At 140 feet, Juan saw the reflection of his dive light off the surface of the water below him. The water was perfectly still. As he got lower, he finally saw evidence that the pit was still connected to the sea. The rock was damp from high tide, and mussels clumped like black grapes clung to the stone, awaiting the tide's return. He could also tell that the ocean's access to the pit had to be limited. The tidal mark was only a few feet tall.
"Hold on a sec," Juan ordered.
"Looks like you've reached the water," Max said, watching the scene on the laptop.
"Okay. Lower slowly."
Juan didn't know what lay under the surface and didn't want to be impaled.
"Hold again."
When his foot made contact with the water, he kicked around, feeling for any submerged obstruction. It was clear.
"Okay. Down another foot."
They repeated this until the chairman was completely submerged and he could see for himself that the pit was clear. He dumped a little air from his buoyancy compensator so that he sank to the full stretch of the cable.
"Visibility is about 20 feet, he reported.
Even through the dry suit, he could feel the cold Pacific's embrace. Without the dive light, he was in a Stygian world. There wasn't enough sun from the surface to penetrate this deep into the pit.
"Give me some slack."
Cabrillo finned deeper into the pit. When he approached bottom at 80 feet, he realized that Dwayne Sullivan had pulled a fast one. He had used the excuse of the two accidents to call a halt to his exploration, when in fact it looked like they had hit bottom only to discover the pit was empty. They had removed all the debris and found nothing. He swept his hand over the thin layer of silt covering the rock floor. The coating was only knuckle deep. Below it, the rock was smooth against his fingertips, as though it had been ground flat. The only interesting feature was a man-sized niche just above the pit's terminus.
"I think this is a bust," he told Max. "There's nothing down here."
"I can see that." Hanley adjusted the control on the laptop to sharpen the picture because of the cloud of silt Juan had kicked up. A squirrel paused as it scampered by, gave him an angry tail twitch, and ran off. A noise suddenly caught Max's attention. It wasn't the motion alarm, but something far worse. A low-flying helicopter was approaching. It had been coming on at wave-top height, so the island masked the beat of its rotors until it was almost atop him.
"Juan! Chopper!
Pull me up!" Cabrillo shouted.
"I will, but this'll be over by the time you get up here."
This was a move by the Argentines that they had discussed, but had no real defense against. Hanley had only seconds to react. The helicopter sounded like it was headed for the beach where he and Juan had come ashore. It was the only logical landing site. Max mashed the control button to winch Cabrillo back to the surface, grabbed Juan's pistol from the seat next to him, and jumped from the SUV. He started running as fast as he could, drawing his own pistol from its holster. He calculated the odds that the Argentines had brought their own pilot to the United States to be pretty slim, meaning the guy at the controls had been hired to fly them out to Pine Island. If Max could get there quickly enough, there was a chance he could stop them from landing. His legs were burning after only a few 100 yards, and it felt like his heart was going to explode out of his chest. His lungs convulsed as they fought to draw air. The extra pounds he carried around his middle weighed him down like an anchor. But he pushed through the pain, running with his head down and his arms pumping. The rotor beat changed. He knew the pilot was flaring the helo to land. Max actually growled as he charged down the overgrown track. His 60-plus years seemed to melt away. His feet suddenly felt like they were dancing over the ground, barely making contact with the earth. Hanley exploded from the forest. Ahead of him was the beach, and just above it was a civilian Jet Ranger helicopter. The water was being whipped mercilessly by the rotor downwash as it slowly sank earthward. Max saw the outline of a couple of men in the rear seats. The range was extreme for the Glocks, and when he skidded to a halt, his body trembled, but he raised the pistols anyway. He aimed away from the Jet Ranger's cockpit and started pulling the triggers, firing right and left so the report from each weapon turned into one continuous roar. In just a few seconds, he put up a 30-round curtain of lead. He had no idea how many rounds hit the chopper, but he knew some had. The rear door was thrown open, and one of the Argentines prepared to jump for the ground, 10 feet below the skids. The pilot reacted by increasing power and starting to veer away. Max dropped the pistol in his left hand and thumbed the magazine out of the other. The man in the door slid forward, trying to compensate for the tilting aircraft. In the fastest changeout he'd performed since Vietnam, Hanley had a fresh magazine in the Glock, and the slide closed before the Argentine could jump. He fired as quickly as before, his ears ringing with the concussive blasts. The guy in the open door suddenly jerked and fell free. He made no attempt to right himself as he plummeted into the surf. Hanley could imagine what was happening on the Jet Ranger. The Argentine major would be screaming at the pilot to turn back to the island, most likely threatening him with a weapon, while the pilot would want to put as much distance between him and the madman shooting at him as possible. Max slid home another magazine, waiting and watching to see who would win the test of wills. After a few seconds, it was clear the chopper wasn't coming back. It flew due west, presenting as small a target as possible. In moments, it was just a white dot against the gray sky. The only question in Hanley's mind now was whether the Argentines would let the pilot live. He didn't like the man's chances. They'd already proven themselves ruthless, and he doubted they would leave an eyewitness alive. His chest was still pumping when he finally started walking toward the beach. The Argentine who'd fallen from the Jet Ranger lay face down about 15 feet from shore. Max kept his pistol trained on the man and waded into the frigid waters, sucking air through his teeth when it reached his waist. He grabbed the man's hair and lifted his head free. The eyes were open and fixed. Max turned the body. His shot had hit the guy square in the heart, and had he actually been aiming there, it would have been a remarkable shot. As it turned out, though, it was just dumb luck. There was no ID in the man's pockets, only a little cash plus a sodden pack of cigarettes and a disposable lighter. Max unburdened the man of his money and towed the body toward the beach. When it was shallow enough, Hanley started stuffing rocks into the man's clothes. It took him a few minutes, but eventually the body began to sink. Max dragged him back into deeper water again and let go. With the body weighted and the tide ebbing, the corpse would never be seen again. He grabbed up the pistol he'd dropped and started back. While he wanted to run, his body simply wasn't up to it. He had to settle for a loping trot that still made his knees scream in protest. It had taken him less than 7 minutes to reach the coastline, but it took more than 15 for the return journey. Max expected to see Juan, but there was no sign of the chairman. To his dismay, the winch hadn't reeled up the cable. He looked at the control box and realized he had hit the down button by mistake. A glance at the front bumper revealed that the cable drum had completely paid out the line. He lowered himself onto the SUV's rear seat and settled the headphones over his mouth. He frowned when he saw the feed from Juan's camera showed nothing but electronic snow. Juan, do you copy? Over. Max should have been able to hear the chairman breathing inside his dive helmet, but all he heard was silence, a silence with a sense of finality behind it. Hanley to Cabrillo, do you copy? Over. He tried 3 more times, his concern deepening with each unanswered hail. He decided not to reel in the cable, but instead jumped out of the Ford and hauled up the separate fiber optic line hand over hand. After just a few seconds, he knew it was no longer attached to anything. Thin filament tangled at his feet as he frantically yanked it from the earth. When the end appeared at last, he held it up to examine the break. It didn't look like it had been sheared cleanly. The plastic coating around the delicate cable was shredded, like it had been abraded between two rough surfaces. He'd seen the video himself. There was nothing in the treasure pit that could have caused such damage. This was when he engaged the winch and stood fretfully as the cable slowly rose from the depths. Like the fiber optics, the braided steel appeared severed. Max bellowed down into the dank shaft until his throat went hoarse, but all that returned was the echo of a very worried man.